Wapping Project is a vision which encapsulates new work, the commissioning of writers, poets, choreographers, composers, filmmakers, video makers and photographers.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Pass Forward, the Wapping Project at 20. My name is Gareth Evans. I'm the host of this ongoing podcast series looking at the past, present and future-facing thinking and action of the Wapping Project, extraordinary cross-platform, cross-arts project created, initiated and directed by the late, great Jules Wright and now co-directed by Marcia Michalowska and Thomas Zanon-Archer. We're delighted in this episode to welcome the writer Alia Trabuco-Zaran. Welcome, Alia.
Hello, lovely to, well, talk to you today.
It's great that you can join us all the way from Santiago in Chile. And we're here to talk about your commissioned story for the Wapping Project for their publication, Resonance. But before we get to that, you actually had made a different overture, shall we say, approach to the Wapping Project. You'd applied for a place in their Berlin residency programme. Now, that didn't quite work out as you'd hoped, I think, but you did obviously then get commissioned. Could you recall for us how you first came across the Wapping Project?
Yes, well, actually, I would say when I tell this story, I always say it's my most successful unsuccessful application. Because it was, well, I a friend of mine actually applied to their residency and went to Berlin for that lovely month of writing and resting in the flat the Wapping Project has there, and I decided to apply, so which I did, and I didn't get the place, I didn't get the residency, but I got an email from Thomas and Marta asking me if we could meet actually, and so because I was in London back then, we met, had a cup of coffee, and then They told me about this project they were doing. They liked the piece that I showed them for the application, and they wanted to commission something with this topic in mind, resonance, which is strangely something I was thinking about. So it went really well for me, and I enjoyed writing the piece a lot, really.
Yeah, that's tremendous. I mean, I like that idea of most successful, unsuccessful application. I have to declare an interest here, of course, is that I was also on the selection committee for that residency round that you applied for. Part of that selection, we were, I seem to remember now, I can stand corrected, that there were issues around scheduling of the shortlisted applicants, but we were absolutely overwhelmed and really struck by your wonderful piece of writing that you submitted for that application. So I'm really glad that, of course, this further commission came out of that process. Now, you presented a story, as you mentioned, for Resonance, and this has been an ongoing theme in the Wapping Project's recent work. And your story, The Last Word, was translated for you by Sophie Hughes, of course, your ongoing translator relationship. We've spoken to Sophie in an earlier episode of this series. But when you were given the idea of the Resonance Commission, what prompted you then to take it in the direction that you did with the story, The Last Word?
It was really, for me, sort of like a perfect fit. Like when Marta and Thomas mentioned the word resonance, they actually mentioned the word echo specifically. And that I had written a piece recently about the myth of Narciso and being and the listening of the losing of one's voice, and at the same time I was thinking whether like words in particular can have an echo in the body, and what would that echo or that resonance be? So I was thinking specifically about blushing, and isn't it really striking the fact that a word can cause such a physical reaction, like the fact that our faces really change colors, and that can be triggered like literally by saying or by listening to a particular word. So I was thinking really about shame and also anger, and how specifically language has the power of creating such a like visible echo or resonance in the body. So and because of that reflection, I remember this game that's called El Teléfono in Chile. It's called the broken telephone, so El Teléfono Roto in Argentina, and it's called Chinese Whispers, I think, in England. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to work on the idea of cruelty and shame in childhood. So that's how I started thinking about that particular story.
Thank you very much indeed. I mean, you're absolutely right about this sort of this embodied reaction to the spoken, or perhaps even to the written as well, in terms of how we respond. And rarely, I think, has that been kind of so rewardingly communicated and explored as in your story. Now, you're translated by Sophie Hughes, who also translated your remarkable novel, The Remainder. She's one of our great contemporary translators, from Spanish into English. Can you remember how you first met Sophie? Was she someone you knew yourself, or was it someone proposed by your publisher and other stories?
No, not at all. I think Sophie is to blame for the fact that the novel has been translated, and for the fact that I have such a great agent. It was a common friend of the writer, Carlos Fonseca, who had read my novel in Spanish, and he actually recommended the novel to Sophie, and they are friends. And then he gave the copy to Sophie, and Sophie rang me on the phone, which is already kind of weird that people actually like getting a phone call and not an email or an audio or a message. And she called me. She had just finished the book, and she said, "This is a novel I will translate." She was very confident and very enthusiastic, and she really. I thought she commented on the book and said why she liked it, and I immediately fully trusted her. Really, then she sent a sample of the first chapter, and I thought she was just great. And then we met at the British Library, then we met at my flat, and I think her job translating this particular novel, but also the short story, and in general everything she does. She's sort of a magician in the sense that she not only grasps the meaning or the multiple meaning of words, but also the melody, the mm-hmm. song that I tried singing through my characters, and she somehow found that song in English, which is not exactly the same one as in Spanish, but it worked. It worked well, and for me that was just like a gift. And also we became friends after that, and she's translating now my new book. So I feel very, very, very lucky to have met her.
No, that's tremendous, and I'm not surprised at all to hear of Sophie's active engagement with, you know, a book, and of course, and then with you as the writer, and her sort of hands-on involvement with Spanish text. That's really tremendous. We should remind listeners, of course, The Remainder was your debut novel and went on to extraordinary success, made a big impact, and was shortlisted for the 2019 Man Booker International Prize. It's great to hear you have a new book coming soonish, can we say? Is that something we can look forward to in 2021?
It is, actually, yeah. It will be published it was already published in Spanish, and it will be published by Another Stories, the great indie publisher in the UK. So I'm very happy that it's going to be them again introducing this new, very different book to the UK audience. So, and again, it's Sophie who's the translator of this different piece of writing, and I'm quite thrilled. I think it will be published in the second half of 2021.
Tremendous. That's great. And what's very striking about your writing, of course, in The Remainder, for example, you know, is how children are thinking through the legacies of parental activities, of course, on a national scale in the case of the novel, with the traumatic legacies of the Pinochet dictatorship. And that, of course, very sadly, that kind of upheaval and unrest is apparent now on the streets of Chile, with a very hard-headed response to recent protests. But then you find a way in the story, The Last Word, of course, to take on larger implications, if you like, through a very personal story, through, again, relations between children in this case, within a certain structure, with implication and the unsaid as active as what is declared. And I wonder if there's a sense when you are considering writing a story, ideas are gathering. If you now notice across shorter or longer form work, whether there's a pattern as to whether an idea gathers around an image or a line or something observed, can you identify now a kind of pattern to how stories originate for you?
I think maybe I can. I'm not entirely sure. I'm the sort of person that loves thinking and reading essays and learning things. So sometimes it's an idea, really. And that idea turns into an image, and then that image turns into a story. And particularly with what you were saying of children, because it's something that's common between like the remainder and the last word, is the fact that it's children, that the ones who are dealing with violence somehow, mm-hmm. right? And I think there's some freedom in the imagination of children and how they approach violence and how they can be cruel, really, and also without really having a moral moral reaction to that violence. That really interests me, also philosophically. So I think for me the process tends to be a mixture of reflection and imagination, where reflection tends to be an idea, something that I'm thinking about. For example, I was thinking about shame back then, and shame and the embodiment of shame, and which is blushing. And I was reading about that, like theory, and then that sort of merged with imagination, and also with memory of this childhood game, and how I played along, and at the same time I was a very shy child, very afraid, I think, because of the background of the dictatorship, afraid of many unknown, unsaid things. So I think all of these elements, intellectual and imaginative, and the freedom also of writing, are just merged together, and then the process tends to be quite... I just work a lot. I know some writers say, like, well, I just sit down and it all flows and it's very magic. But for me, it's all about work as well, and working the rhythm and reading out loud and just polishing and polishing and polishing until you manage to find something that you like. So this is, for me, I know it maybe takes away that idea that writers are sort of like struck by genius, but I don't feel that's my case at all. My case is like about reading and sitting down and waiting and being patient. And sometimes it's also about remembering. I was reading this poem by the poet Gluck, the one who just Louise Gluck, who just won the Nobel Prize, and mm-hmm. she has this this verse that says, "We look at the world once in childhood, and the rest is just memory." Mm-hmm. There's something about that for me, about trying to access that first glance into the world. You know, that first time that you look at the world, and trying to work with that. There's something about that, I think, in this story.
Tremendous. Well, we're very glad indeed that you've been obviously reading and working and waiting and then working again to create your wonderful text, whether a novel length or a short story length in the case of The Last Word. If you haven't read The Last Word, you can read it on the Wapping Project website under the commissions tab of the menu. Please do find it there in the publication Resonance, wonderfully translated by Sophie Hughes. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, Alia. Thank you very much indeed for coming to us today from Santiago, and all wishes and the very best for your new book into English in 2021. Many thanks to And Other Stories for making that possible for us, and thank you for being with us, Alia Trepelko-Zeran.
Thank you so much, Gareth, and thank you to the Wapping Project and to Thomas and Martha.
And now I'm delighted to introduce a reading of Alia's story, The Last Word, translated, of course, by Sophie Hughes and read for us here by actor Polly Kemp.
The game begins when the circle closes, when everyone takes a chair and drags it to its new place. Metal feet scrape against the floor. Some of the chairs fall. The teacher calls for silence above the noise. The children are 7 years old, and those chairs are too big for them. It won't be long before they grow into them, but right now, today, the tips of their toes barely reach the floor. With a clap, the teacher announces that it's time to start. The voices settle down. The children await her instructions impatiently. There are 30 of them in a perfect circle. 30 children paying close attention to the rules. The first, to listen. The second, to repeat. It's a very simple game. The children nod. They're ready. The teacher is too. She clears her throat, licks her lips, and looks up to the ceiling. She seems to be searching for the word up there. One word among many, among all the words. And when at last she finds it, she smiles. The game can begin. The teacher leans in towards the boy to her right. He will be the first to hear the word, the first to repeat it. After him, there'll come another, and another, and another, until it reaches the end. Circles, so they say, have no end. They are infinite. But not this one. This circle has a beginning, a middle, and at the end, there is a girl. She is sitting on the teacher's left, steadily biting her nails. Some time ago, she decided to stop talking. Today, it is her job to announce the secret word. She is the last girl. And that girl is me. She leans forwards to watch the space between the teacher and the first boy. Those few centimetres between her mouth and his ear. That empty space which, any moment now, will be flooded with letters. It's a straightforward circular course. Mouth, ear, mouth. The room hums with anticipation. Everyone wants to hear the word, to know what it is. She tries to lip-read some syllable that might give her a clue. Every now and then she thinks she sees it on the children's breath as it spills from inside their mouths. This morning they woke to another frost. The grass dawned white and crisp and their seats were ice cold. The teacher tried to turn on the heater, but to no avail. She said it was broken, that they'd fix it. But Pablo, who sits next to the girl, tells her they're doomed. He says pretty soon their fingers will freeze and drop off. Pablo's shirt is dirty. His nails are black. His head is shaved and he shares a desk with the last girl. She doesn't like that place. She doesn't like the chalk dust or Pablo or the shouting or the white cold blown from their mouths. The game, on the other hand, she does like. Listening and repeating. Speaking. How hard can it be? The teacher made her sit next to Pablo on the first day of school. She was at the other end of the classroom at the back when she heard her surname. The voice told her to collect her things and come quickly to the front. And the girl accepted that punishment as if she really deserved it. She left her place in silence and sat down in the front row. There, each morning, she was kicked in the shin and had her hair pulled. "A nice, quiet girl will be a good influence," the voice ruled. "She'll have a calming effect on that rowdy boy, on the problem child." Little does the teacher know how wrong she is. It will take a lot more than that to calm down the boy. Time will make him taller, broader, his voice deeper and brasher. With each passing year, he will take up more space in the world. At age 10, he will be much stronger than at 9. By age 11, he will be significantly taller than at 10. By the time he is 15, he will have understood that he can break a nose with his bare fist. At 20, he will discover that he can break much more than that. And by 30, finally, he'll break himself. The collision will leave 3 whole streets without power. But at last, that night, Pablo will have calmed down. The girl often has thoughts like these. Broken noses, long drawn-out deaths. Futures in which every single person gets exactly what they deserve. Pablo, for example, deserves to grow up, crash his car and be smashed to pieces. And she deserves to die too, Pablo tells her as much day in, day out. He tells her she should start thinking about how. Freezing to death, he suggests. Drowning at the bottom of the sea. A blow to the back of the head. He tells her she'd better make up her mind as soon as possible. How you die matters. The word continues along its course. It has passed through 10 mouths, which means there are now fewer, far fewer, before it reaches hers. She feels the saliva in her mouth thicken, go warm and sour. Pablo, meanwhile, won't stop fidgeting. The teacher tells him to settle down, but it's useless. Equally useless is the pill they give him each morning. It's called Ritalin, and it numbs the tips of your fingers. Pablo pretends to swallow it, but then passes it, wet, under the table to her. Don't say a word, he warns her. And the girl obediently puts it in her mouth. The pill dissolves on her tongue, and she waits to disappear with it. But she only feels a tingling and a soft, expansive sadness. And in her sadness, she is struck by strange ideas. Ideas like how Pablo, in the future, will crack all his teeth against a windshield, or how inside the body there is no light or shade, or how one day she'll wake up and everyone will have lost their voice. It's strange, this game. Different from the rest. No winners, no losers. The sole object is to keep the word intact. Ensure that the letters don't wear out. That their passage from mouth to mouth doesn't change them. Each morning at the start of term, the class chooses a new game. To get to know one another, the teacher says. To make friends. They've already played hide and seek and musical chairs. And now the girl is convinced they have chosen this game for her. The teacher insisted that the girl went last, that she sat to her left. And there she is, the last child, paralysed by the very idea of speaking and by all those eyes on her. She would like to go outside, far, far away, outside of that classroom, outside of herself. She detests how the others giggle as they pass the word from mouth to mouth. She wonders what it could be. Strip light, building, humidity, ceiling. Something the teacher saw up there when she looked up and smiled. Or maybe the secret word is frost. At least that's what it should be. The glacial air tints the word white every time it leaves the mouth. Ear, mouth, ear, mouth. It has now made its way around half the room. Soon enough it will be her turn and there'll be no escape. Next to her, Pablo scratches his head, whistles and twitches. This is also the cause of his stutter. His flailing arms and legs send the letters flying. F-f-f-fatso, he calls her. B-b-b-bitch. Every one of the girls' exercise books contains smudges because of him. Messages that Pablo gives her without so much as touching her pencil. With his juddering leg, he sends shockwaves through their shared desk. The boy and the girl, the fool and the thinker, the bully and the mute. That's what they call her, the mute. But in her mind, in silence, she is speaking all the time. Sometimes, unconsciously, she even moves her lips. She poses a question, then answers it. It's a never-ending dialogue. Then Pablo appears, elbows her and says, "Who are you talking to, stupid? Who are you arguing with, weirdo?" She doesn't respond out loud. She prefers not to hear her own voice. That way, no one is able to say anything about her. And she, in turn, can't say what she fears she might. 20 of the children have had their turn. There aren't many left to go and Pablo is becoming increasingly skittish, rocking violently in his seat. He nearly loses his balance. This running motion to her left unsettles the girl. She pictures the seat falling backwards and hears a thud. A pool of blood forms on the floor and swells until it reaches her dangling feet. The word, meanwhile, advances as if it's shed letters or whole syllables and is now much shorter. Roof, cloud, girl, mute. Those who've already heard it can hardly wait. They start whispering among themselves and shuffling in their seats. But Pablo is the worst of all. Pablo keeps shouting and groaning so that no one can hear the true word. To ruin the game. 7 to go. 6. The low murmur builds to a noise and then a racket. The teacher loses her patience. She turns to Pablo and warns him that if he isn't quiet that instant, he will be punished. He'll go without lunch, she says, without break time, without friends, without his pill, without. She still hasn't understood that Pablo can't stop. He doesn't know how to stop. The girl, on the other hand, knows she's going to die. Pablo whispered as much in her ear. He told her that one of these days, in the middle of the night, she'll discover she can't climb out of her own muteness. She'll be stuck there in a dark, silent tomb. And by way of preparation, because it's good to be prepared, the girl practices dying. In the middle of all the commotion, she closes her eyes, grits her teeth and holds her breath for as long as possible. What doesn't make a sound doesn't exist, she repeats to herself. What doesn't make a sound isn't there. But then she hears the beat of her own heart and starts breathing again. The word continues on its round. It won't be long now. 5 miles, 4, 3. You can hear stifled yelps, impatient squeaks. The girl knows there's no going back. There are only 2 to go now, and Pablo can't contain himself. He leans back in his chair, balancing on the 2 rear legs, and lets himself fall. The word reaches him at that precise moment. It slips into his ear and stays there, trapped. He frowns, bites his lip, and thinks. This isn't a game that requires thought. Listen and repeat. That's all Pablo has to do, and yet he won't do it. The other children hurry him up. Even the teacher hurries him up. They shout at him to go on, to come out and say the word. The girl also wants to shout, louder than any of them. She gives it a go. Why not? Filling up her chest and parting her lips, but the other children's voices rush in, shaking her. Pablo has the word, and now he smiles, a forced grimace that terrifies the girl. The fear dries out her mouth, wakes her up. She feels more alert than ever. Alive, that's it. She wonders if the game might not be a diversion tactic, to distract them from their frozen hands, their blue nails, their mutilated fingers on the floor. She is lost in this thought, even more terrified now. And Pablo, as if he knew, takes advantage of her distractedness. He tilts his head to the right, cups his hands around his mouth and leans into her ear. The word peels away from his lips and reaches the girl. She hears it with absolute clarity. She knows it. A blast of heat rises up from her chest towards her face as if that word had turned to fire in her body. As if in the middle of the classroom, the girl was burning alive. She hears shouting all around. Say it! Say it! She is the obedient girl, the good girl. She knows the rules of the game. The first, to listen. The second, to repeat. Her lips move. She can't help it. Soundlessly they pronounce the word that she's heard. And she repeats it twice as if practicing it. Then, caught up in her own muttering, she feels a punch in the back of her neck. It's Pablo, his eyes blazing. He knows that he and the girl alone share the word, that mortifying word that she's supposed to reveal. The game dictates it. The shouts dictate it. And she is a girl who does what others dictate. Without a second thought, she stands up, takes 2 steps forward and stops in the centre of the circle. Her throat closes up, her palms are sweaty and her mouth tastes tangy. The children around her fall silent. They'd forgotten all about this girl, but now, suddenly, they remember her. Her hands are clenched, her hair is in pigtails, her shoes are unpolished and her heart is beating wildly. What's more, she has her eyes closed. If she can't see, she can't be seen. If only it were that simple. Nobody dares interrupt her. They all want to hear the word, the last word, the word that this girl has heard and must now repeat. She swallows, takes a deep breath, and forces herself to open her eyes. She notices the lifeless heater. Outside, it's drizzling. She doesn't know what to do. She looks up, hoping to find a clue. The ceiling is white, blank, and that blankness gives her the answer. It's so simple, so easy to lie. She only has to switch a noun, one little word. The girl hesitates, thinks about it, but the moment she opens her mouth, she can't contain her own voice. It's like bodies in water. Once they push off, once they dive in, nothing can stop them. Nothing can recover the word now that it's left her mouth. It doesn't sound like her. It's as if a new voice has emerged. The children listen carefully and, after a moment's pause, burst out laughing. More like shouts than laughter. Wild, shrieking hoots. And nobody's looking at her anymore. All of them, she included, lock eyes on Pablo. And all of them, in unison, repeat the last word. Ritalin. Ritalin. It's a tiny, bitter pill. And this time, it has its intended effect. Pablo looks at her, baffled, his face flushing redder by the second. Now he is the mute. Finally, he is silent.
In the next episode, I will be in conversation with Marta Michalowska and Thomas Zanon-Larcher, close collaborators with Jules Wright during the Popping Project's life in the hydraulic power station, and now co-directors as they take the project forward onto new platforms across media and into territories previously unknown to the Wapping Project across the world, from the Middle East to the Outer Hebrides. I do hope you can join us next week on Pass Forward, the Wapping Project at 20. Thank you very much indeed for listening.